Welcome to this edition of Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host for this episode, Dr. Mark Dubin from Baltimore, Maryland. Today, we will be discussing the article, Spending, Utilization, and Coverage for Chronic Rhinosinusitis with Nasal Polyposis, Therapies Among Medicare Advantage Beneficiaries, which was published in February 2024. I'm joined by the second author, Dr. Vinay Rathi from Ohio State University. Welcome, Vinay. Congratulations to you and your co-authors on the publication. I would like to start off by applauding your efforts to get a handle on the real-world drug utilization for CRS with polyps. I personally feel that the use of some of the current therapies, biologics specifically, is growing beyond the point of sustainability and at the expense of more traditional, efficacious, cheaper, and potentially less morbid options based solely on my personal non-scientific observations. With that said, let's start by talking about what interested you in this topic.
Yes, and thanks, Mark, for having us and highlighting the study. The reason we did this is because it seems like these novel therapies are all anyone in our field is talking about these days. And a big part of that conversation is cost. So we just wanted to put some, as you said, real world numbers to the problem. And so we're hoping that'll help our readers figure out where they fit relative to contemporary practice, but also to better counsel patients on out-of-pocket costs, because it's very easy for all of us to tell patients, well, you know, we could start this medication, but it could be expensive. And it's a lot more useful if we can tell them, hey, this could be on the order of a couple thousand bucks.
Great. Briefly, describe your methodology, particularly what therapies you looked at and how you got your data.
So the four therapies we looked at were all recently approved by the FDA for this indication: dupilumab, omalizumab, mepolizumab, and fluticasone exhalation delivery system, which is a mouthful and I'm just going to call XHANCE from here on out. We looked at disease-specific spending. So that's spending on claims where the associated diagnosis was CRS with in the Medicare Advantage population between 2000 and 2022. It's worth noting that the Medicare Advantage population has long been a growing segment of the Medicare population overall, and it's actually now this year surpassed fee-for-service enrollment. We looked at the Medicare Advantage population that is covered by United Healthcare. That's the largest Medicare Advantage insurer. It has about 30% of the market. So that translates into 9 million lives, you know, per year overall. These data are actually commercially available from Optum Insight, which is the consulting arm of United.
I'm not sure I appreciated that it was mostly the United data, which makes this all the more impressive because United actually doesn't pay for anything on a consistent basis. So, but again, that's my own personal bias. Makes these numbers even more impressive. Anyway, I'll stop from editorializing. So what was the most common therapy that was prescribed for CRS with?
Well, to the point you just made, the most common therapy was none. About 90% of patients weren't on any of these four. But when we looked at the patients who were that 10%, you know, the most common were dupilumab and XHANCE, so about 3 to 4% for each.
Has that changed over time, over the brief, you know, interval that you looked at?
I mean, the study period was, it's more recent data, so necessarily it's a shorter time frame, but it was fairly consistent during the period we looked at. I should also say that mepolizumab was approved for this indication, I think, partway through 2021. So we did see an increase from initial authorization to the subsequent fiscal year. But I think in general, these are the market leaders.
So tell me and us about what you found about the various costs of all these therapies that you looked at.
So like I said, we looked at condition-specific costs. So those are specific to the diagnosis of CRS with. And the costs that I'm showing are fully loaded. So they include surgery for patients who had surgery, clinic visit fees, CT scans, all of that stuff.
So to be clear, sorry to interrupt, but it's everything that's associated with that individual patient who was prescribed, you know, one of these medications.
Yes. That said, the majority of the costs for any patients who are on these drugs were driven by the drug. So we're trying to give a comprehensive picture and, you know, because we didn't want folks to say, well, what if, you know, being on this drug, you know, reduces all those other things? And the answer was no, most of the cost is still attributable to the drug. The condition-specific costs were highest for the patients receiving dupilumab, so $28,000 per beneficiary per year, and 90% of that was the cost of dupilumab. Those costs are even higher than costs for other biologics. I mean, all biologics we know are expensive relative to things like Flonase nasal spray or oral steroids or what have you. But even compared to other biologics, dupilumab was more than $10,000 more expensive as compared to mepolizumab or omalizumab. And Xhance, you know, was the cheapest of the bunch. That cost about $6,000 a year, or less than 1/4 what dupilumab did. What's interesting here is, you know, those are the costs total to the patient and the payer, but the out-of-pocket costs to the patient were not consistently proportional. So out-of-pocket costs for omalizumab were $3,000, which is about 20% of the total cost, you know, which is $15,000. But out-of-pocket costs were actually lower for dupilumab, even though overall dupilumab is much more expensive for the payer to cover. That was an interesting finding of the study, that the incentives were not necessarily aligned between patients and payer when you think about the total cost of the medication and who's paying what.
That's interesting. Also, what was interesting is that there were a number of patients who were prescribed biologics who did not have surgery, which is interesting, particularly for our audience. So tell us, I mean, how did you figure out that they didn't have surgery? And, you know, can you speak to that number of patients?
Most of the patients who were on biologics, you know, had it in that fiscal year, because remember, United doesn't know what happens their entire lifetime. They know what happens while they're covering them.
So it's specific to that year. Okay.
Yeah. They had asthma and did not have surgery. That said, it was about 80% across the board. And, you know, for patients who were receiving all these therapies that didn't have surgery, we know that they didn't have surgery because there was no claim, unless patients are going and paying 100% of that out of pocket by themselves and working around United. You know, and this is something that came up during the reviews. As someone who takes care of patients, you're thinking about their 5-year, their 10-year horizon. You know, what is their trajectory of their care going to be? How many surgeries they're going to have? What's the net benefit here? But the insurer doesn't think that way, because there's huge turnover year over year. In the Medicare Advantage population, there's like 50% churn over 5 years, 15% over the first year. Even though that's what we want to know, you got to think about the people who are making these coverage policies and denying our surgeries or approving our surgeries or denying, you know, dupilumab. What they care about is, am I going to take this hit in this next year? Because that's the only year they know for sure that you're going to be their liability.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. So you alluded to it a little bit, but most of the, you know, a fair share of the biologics that were prescribed are dupilumab or Dupixent. So can you just kind of summarize your thoughts overall, you know, why that's the case? Is it just the out-of-pocket, or are there other aspects of it as well?
I think there's definitely a couple aspects in addition to that. You know, the first is probably brand awareness. So dupilumab is one of the most heavily advertised drugs in the world, not just in our field or in otolaryngology or in surgery. Just, I think the manufacturer spent about $500 million last year advertising it. Physicians are familiar with it, and patients might be asking for it by name. There's the economic incentive to the patients that we discussed about the lower out-of-pocket costs, but also there was widespread coverage. Virtually 100% of plans cover dupilumab. So if a physician and patient are talking about it, they're like, oh, your insurance covers it. Oh, the out-of-pocket cost is $1,000 a year, and, you know, Xolair is going to be $3,000 a year. It's an easy math for them. And then some of that also probably has to do with what physicians are familiar with in terms of the literature and their own experience and how they interpret the data with efficacy. There's no comparative effectiveness trials have been done, but some of that has to do with the evidence and people's experience, I'm sure.
So shifting gears to include Xhance a little bit in the therapy, because it is approved for CRS with polyposis, obviously. You mentioned in your manuscript that there's a difference between the pre-auth and step therapy between biologics and Xhance. Would you mind telling us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so step therapy is a specific kind of prior auth where you have to fail a stepwise progression of treatments that are hopefully proven to be effective, but generally speaking, less expensive before the insurer will go ahead and pay for a more expensive treatment. And so we thought it was interesting that I just mentioned how dupilumab was covered by basically all of the plans. I think only 35% of plans covered Xhance. And then no plans required any sort of step therapy for biologics, which we thought was really interesting, whereas about 20% of them required step therapy for Xhance. That may be something as simple as saying, hey, have you tried fluticasone for X number of weeks? Or sorry, Flonase, you know, by the conventional method for X number of weeks before we go ahead and pay for something that's a little bit more expensive. So again, you know, we kind of mentioned how the patient and payer out-of-pocket incentives didn't seem aligned from the out-of-pocket cost perspective. But what about, you know, from the plan coverage perspective or the number of hoops that they make you jump through before you decide that a treatment is appropriate or medically necessary? So that was another interesting wrinkle of the study that we didn't expect.
Yeah, that is amazing that the amount of hoops that many of the carriers, United included, make you jump through to get XHANCE. But
your point about many of the carriers. So the coverage data was a slightly different data set. That was the Medicare Part D plan formula data set. So we are talking about all payers, all plans when it comes to that data. The spending data was just United, but the coverage data is across all, 7,000 plans that are out there.
Which is fascinating. I'm sure the similar policies and coverages and payments are, I'm sure, comparable across, all. Comparable anyway. At least based on my anecdotal prescribing history, it takes an act of Congress, probably not a great analogy in today's world, but to get to get XHANCE covered, whereas dupilumab, you fill out a paper and it magically, happens. So looking at this from the outside, if you could derive a step therapy for biologics, what do you think it should be? Your own personal opinion.
I think it's what most, I hope, reasonable people probably are doing, which is, you start on Flonase and steroid irrigations, and then, you think about maybe doxycycline or oral steroid burst. And then if that doesn't work, then you move up to budesonide irrigations, knowing that that's off label. And again, if an insurer were to make that part of step therapy, then they should cover that. And then if that doesn't work, then you go to something like XHANCE. And then if all of those things which are reasonable and have proven efficacy don't work, then you kick up to biologics. And so I think hopefully most reasonable people are doing that sort of thing. But it could also be the case, I've heard anecdotally that people don't even really have someone look in the nose with the scope. And they'll be like, oh, you've tried Flonase. I think I see a polyp. Let's go ahead and start dupilumab. You don't want that. That's may not help the patient, but it's certainly a huge cost to the system.
I'm in private practice. I know you just finished your fellowship and are now in academia. There are patients who have not had surgery and do not have and are not written for it for asthma who come in on biologics. And it's an interesting question. It's not by otolaryngologists. It's by by allergists, pulmonologists, primary care physicians. And it's an interesting aspect of all this that you put a group of X number of rhinologists or otolaryngologists in a room together, they will uniformly describe what you just said. And, assuming a patient is a surgical candidate and does not have medical comorbidities that prevent a surgical intervention, would uniformly obviously have surgery in there in the middle of all of that before biologics. And the question, which will be interesting to see as this progresses and this question is evaluated over the next 5 years, is what percentage of patients is that actually happening? And it's a little harder in your data because it's again just for that one year. But anyway, I'll get off my soapbox.
I've thought about doing that study. I figured I wouldn't make too many friends, but what I'll say is, some of that may be they're more scared of surgery than we are. They don't understand what it entails. Some of it may be, they think there's going to be a long wait time, or they don't know how good of a surgeon we are, or whatever. But some of it is financial incentives, because dupilumab, that's self-administered, but like omalizumab, for instance, that can be administered in the clinic. And then you get into a situation where you're in a buy and bill, where they buy the drug and then they mark it up. And, if it's a private practice office, they retain the revenue. Even in an academic setting, there may be some flow through depending on, how the comp plan set up. But there is some financial incentive for physicians to administer drugs in the office. But that's not unique to biologics.
Yeah. No. Yeah. 100%. And in all that is that if a medical provider sees a whole bunch of people who never do well after sinus surgery, the extrapolation is, well, no one's going to do good with sinus surgery. Might as well skip right to this medication, and they work. No one's arguing that they work. So, what were your take home lessons?
Well, first, the penetrance of biologics was fairly low in this Medicare Advantage population, less than 10% of patients who had a diagnosis of CRS with. The second is that biologics are indeed expensive, but they don't all cost the same to patients or payers. There's difference in the manufacturer's price that payers end up paying and through pharmacies or not. And then there's a difference that the patients are on the hook for in terms of out-of-pocket costs. Dupilumab was the most commonly prescribed biologic and also the most expensive. It costs about twice what omalizumab does. I'm not making any statements about the relative efficacy of the two. It's just what the medications cost. And so you got to ask yourself, why is this happening? These insurance companies are pretty sophisticated. So there must be a reason that they're willing to pay more for dupilumab. If I had to speculate why I think that's happening, it's not something I wrote in the paper because I didn't know if it was the right audience. And this is purely conjecture, but a lot of these Medicare Advantage insurers are vertically integrated. So like United owns OptumRx, which is a pharmacy benefits manager. And they have to spend a certain amount on care. They have something called a medical loss ratio, which I think is like 85%. So if you think about it, maybe United is fine paying a lot for dupilumab as a payer because it helps them meet their medical loss ratio. But then their pharmacy benefit manager, which is OptumRx, is negotiating rebates with the pharmaceutical manufacturers. And at the end of the day, those rebates flow to the whole organization. So the whole organization's profiting, even if the payer side has to pay a little bit more so that the pharmacy benefit manager side can take home a bigger rebate. I'm guessing that's why we found these contradictory results. But you kind of have to ask yourself, well, what about us patients and payers at the end of this, you know, trying to make sense of what the right thing to do is and why, you know, this costs that much and that costs that much, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. And I was hoping you would get to that as well, because that's not something that is commonly appreciated is the pharmacy aspect of these payers as well, and how they maybe, you know, their entire United Healthcare may be benefiting, you know, the entire United organization may be benefiting from one division paying more for, you know, for something.
I mean, again, I have nothing against the guys. Like, their consulting arm is, they provided the actuarial support for this analysis. They make this data available. They're just acting rationally given the incentives that are in place in the system. So like I said, that was all my conjecture, but it's the only way I can figure that they come out ahead when the most commonly prescribed drug is the most expensive one and has the lowest out-of-pocket cost for the patient.
So. Yeah, I mean, it's a business. It's a big business. United's a big player. So as we, you know, near the end of this, so how do you think this data generalizes to the overall patient population? Do you think if you had access to similar data on all the other payers, and it would be comparable? My guess is yes.
Well, first I'll say that we've looked at United's commercial population and it's fairly generalizable. You know, commercial payers generally pay more than Medicare. So the numbers are a little bit bigger, but the results are all directionally consistent. And then when you think about across payers, you know, there is variation when it comes to prior authorization across payers, but I think for big ticket items like drugs, all of them are going to take an interest in making sure that the money's being spent the way they want it to be spent. So I feel good about the generalizability.
Well, thank you. Thanks for joining me. This was a great discussion. And again, congratulations to you and your colleagues on your publication. And thank you, of course, to our Scope It Out listeners. This is Mark Dubin for Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology, signing off for now.